Everyone, it's Eugene here and welcome. This is episode 79 of Forensics Talks, and I want to welcome everybody here today. First thing, our guest is going to be Dr. Richard Shepherd, who is a longtime forensic pathologist. And over the course of his career, he's done well over 20,000 autopsies and examinations. He was qualified as a doctor in 1978 and as a consultant pathologist in 1987. As he worked as a forensic pathologist for over 35 years, and I think he's getting on even more in terms of the years right now. But he was routinely involved in the investigation of all types of sudden and suspicious deaths in London, the UK, and around the world. Many of the cases you might even know of because they were very large events. He's the author of two books, and I have them right here. So there is Unnatural Causes and The Seven Ages of Death. And so Seven Ages of Death is about a number of different cases that he's worked on, and more recently, Unnatural Causes. And so the main part of our discussion is going to focus on what is in the contents of these books. And this is a really good, I guess you'd call it a summary of his CV. And I'm sure that even this is not even doing justice to the number of cases and such that he's worked on. So let me bring him in here. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, Eugene. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you very much. Well, I have to thank John Nordby first because we have a mutual friend. And John, if you're listening, thank you very much. He introduced us at the Academy Conference in 2010. Ooh. And actually, I went back and I looked. So I have the 2010 proceedings here, and I noticed that it was February 22nd to 27th. So just about almost 13 years ago to the day we probably met at some point. So
that's very scary. not that we met, that it was 13 years ago is scary.
Yeah, a long time. So, well, let's begin, shall we? I want to ask you about your extensive career and how it all started. And in your book, you talk about one of your first experiences with a young friend of yours. You were 13 years old, and somehow there's a book that appears. And I was wondering if you could tell me about that experience.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was the most formative moment in my life, in a sense. We were 13. We were at school. My friend, his dad was a physician, a general physician. And in his office, he had textbooks on all sorts of medicine, one of which was on to do with forensic medicine. And my friend at school was obviously looking through his dad's office, saw this book, looked in it, saw some really good photos, and thought he'd bring it to school and do a show and tell out of the classroom with his mates, which is what he did. And you can imagine the effect. I was a single sex school, so there were 30 boys. We all trooped off. Because it was the safest place to go to not to be disturbed by it. We all trooped off to the toilets to look at this book because teachers didn't then. Maybe they don't now go to that. We felt safe there, the group of us. You can imagine this gaggle, sort of like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, following this book through the school. Once again, 20 of them said how disgusting and left to play football. Five of them said, yeah, it definitely is, and they left to play. And in the end, I was just so totally fascinated by what I saw in that book. I didn't realize that doctors helped police. I didn't realize that doctors solved crimes. I didn't realize that doctors gave evidence in court. All of this was completely new and just completely hooked me. And that was the start of my interest in forensic medicine.
Interesting. And so what do you think it is about you or maybe other pathologists that you know that makes them unique, that makes them interested in this particular area?
I think it's very varied, actually. I can think of some pathologists who are really focused on the strict academia, the strict scientific processing and deduction. And some of them just like understanding what's going on in the rest of the world. You know, for me, it was understanding the stories and solving the problems of what had happened. You know, it may be scientifically, but more just through knowledge and experience and understanding to be able to say, I can tell what happened here, or I can't tell what happened here. You know, and that for me is working from the crime scene, working from the body, working from some of the science that we get back, being able to tell that story and then communicate it to a jury, because that's the crucial bit in the UK, is telling it to the 12 people sitting opposite you in court.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's almost as if I just thought about it now, is it's like your desire for answers has to overcome your fear of, you know, the body and the gruesomeness and the horror in some cases of what's happening to these individuals.
Yeah, I try not to linger on the individual's last minutes. I always say that the body will tell you the story, but you actually have to ask the right questions. And knowing which questions to ask comes with knowledge and skill and experience. And sometimes, you know, you can say, well, I want to find out X because you've seen two or three cases like that before. And that can sometimes solve a problem.
So when you became a doctor first, and then you were doing like standard autopsies and things like this for a while, but not so much on the forensic side. So I in your book, you talk about, for example, having to examine slides, slide after slide.
Yeah. I mean, we this is the training process. You train to become a doctor. So I spent a year or two working on the wards, treating living people, sometimes making them better, often making them better, I hope. And then I had to train to become a pathologist, which involved at that stage all of the branches of pathology. So chemical pathology, microbiology, and histology, anatomical pathology. And that included diagnosing diseases, diagnosing cancers. So all of that work preceded my switch to then beginning to train to be an autopsy pathologist and a histopathologist and putting that all together. So, you know, there's a sort of a massive background medical pathological knowledge that leads me to where I am, becoming a forensic pathologist.
You mentioned the book, and that was, it was Professor Keith Simpson, I believe. And then, you know, I'm wondering about who were the other people for you that were the idols, were the people that you were being mentored from that were important to you at that time. And this is, again, the year we're talking 80, like 1980.
Yeah, 1980s. I mean, first and foremost, actually, was my professor of anatomic pathology who was really supportive of this strange being that came to see him that said, I want to become a forensic pathologist. And we were lucky at the medical school I was working in then, St. George's Hospital, we actually had a forensic pathologist there, a guy called Rufus Crompton, who sadly has just died, aged about 90-something, who took me under his wing, because it's a very unstructured career in the UK trying to work through this. So those two were very important to me, but also other professors around London, Professor Mant and Professor Keith Simpson and other people were very, very helpful and kind to me and supported me through my career. And, you know, I just, as I look back, I sort of realized how good they were.
Yeah. And you also mentioned in your book about the people that support you at home, right? Like your family and the family structure and how important that is because of the stresses and the timing, bad timing all the time with family and the calls that come late at night and everything else, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's always, I think forensic pathology is not unique. I mean, I can think of many physicians and surgeons and obstetricians where, you know, the calls never come at the perfect time. And certainly early on in my career, we didn't have a time when we were on call or off call. We were always working. The phone could always ring at any moment and take you away maybe for sort of half a day or a whole day. You know, there could be that sort of that time when things disappeared.
Right, right. Let me ask you about the first time that you really had to cut into a body, because I think that's an image that sticks with many people, you know, who are not pathologists, you know, or doctors are just not using it. And by the way, I know what a PM40 is now. So, and for anyone who doesn't know,
if you read the book, achieved sort of iconic status.
Yes,
I really should be getting sort of royalties for this knife.
Yes, it's the scalpel, folks. It's the model.
It's a PM knife that, believe it or not, is 40 millimeters long. You know, I mean, it's nothing.
yeah. So what did it feel like? Or, you know, and you do describe it in the book, but I'm just wondering if you can give us more insight. You know, the first time you're actually taking a knife to a body, it just seems so unnatural to do, but, you know, something that is necessary.
Well, I through my training, of course, I'd worked as a surgical doctor. So I had done some operations on living people under, let me hasten to add, under intense control by supervision by my superiors. And that's what happened to me for my first post-mortem. I mean, I wasn't just suddenly presented with a body and a knife and away you go. I had observed, I had helped, and then one day it was my turn to actually do this. And it was a worrying, concerning process because I wanted to do it right and with respect, and also get the information that I need. But making those first incisions is a strange thing to do, a strange thing that needs support and help to begin with, and you gain the understanding soon after that, you know, this is a process to an end. And the key thing I think that helped me was working in the mortuary space with the anatomical pathology technicians, the mortuary techs that we have, and seeing their skills and their ability to reconstruct so well the bodies that had the postmortems and some that had been injured and damaged in traffic accidents and the like. So, you know, I had immense faith in them. Two, that they would be able to present to the relatives their loved one in a way that was viewable and not distressing.
Right. And I think one of the interesting things and something that I took away from the book was because your career spans such a long time, that being a forensic pathologist in the 70s and 80s changed significantly over the, you know, 30, 40 years. And so I'd like to ask you about what was it like being a forensic pathologist at that time? The first thing that pops into my head is getting called out to the scenes. Like the phone call came right to you.
Yeah. I mean, the phone call was often the senior investigating officer would phone me, and I would go to the scene. Things have changed, but maybe this is me getting old as well as things changing. But there was the pathologists that preceded me, Professor Simpson, Professor Mann, you know, were all really larger than life people, and no one would dare call them anything other than professor or sir. And that rubbed off a bit on me, you know. So, I mean, no one would call me Dick. It would be Dr. Shepherd, and there would be help to move me along. And we were going to the scene, we didn't wear any Tyvek suits. We would wear gloves. And the rule at that time was, you know, you put your hands in your pockets and you didn't leave a fingerprint at the scene. If you did, you would have to pay a fine to the crime scene investigators, usually of a bottle of whiskey, if they found your fingerprint at the scene. So, you know, and then of course we had the discovery of DNA profiling, and the immense development of forensic science and the specializations in forensic science that really, in some ways, took a lot of the weight and the concerns off us, but has changed the crime scene into this scientific laboratory, which it is now. And thank goodness for it, because, you know, we discover so many more things that we simply didn't see at that time.
Yeah. And I mean, you also mentioned, you know, something about the fact that, you know, the forensic pathologist had the status of the forensic pathologist back then. You know, you mentioned like a Superman a person that could never be wrong. You know, their word was taken and it was golden.
Well, yes. I mean, it certainly, I think when I came away from it, Professor Simpson was certainly a man who, you know, stood up and just pontificated in court and just told the court what it was, and no one would dare to challenge him. And then that was changing, and quite right too. You know, maybe the pendulum has swung too far the other way now, in that the forensic pathologist can sometimes be a bit of a punchbag for the defense advocates, defense counsel, sometimes unfairly. But, you know, we have to be able to manage that in the courtroom, as well as the crime scene, as well as doing the post-mortem, as well as doing the scientific evidence. If you can't get your information across to the jury, then no matter how good you are for the other things, that's not helping the state or the defense or whoever, the court overall, to understand what's going on. And that's the crucial thing. It's the court. I don't care about anyone else understanding, as long as the jury get it right and can take that information to the jury room.
Yeah, you, in your book, I mean, you talk about your father and the Alexander Pope, poems and things like that. And you strike me as a person that's very scientific. So you're looking for facts, trying to keep things very logical. But you also talk about something in your book, and you mentioned the elasticity of truth. And so I'd like to ask you about the elasticity of truth and what you mean by that.
Well, it really... We whiz into philosophy here, don't we? And John, if you're listening, I apologize because I did listen when you spoke to me about this. But the truth is such a flexible thing in a court of law. I mean, many people watching this will know that the judge will allow or disallow some evidence. And sometimes they allow evidence that you think is unreasonable, and sometimes they disallow evidence that you think is crucial. And then, you know, the jury doesn't know that. The jury doesn't know what it doesn't know. And you have to try and then convey information with the to them with the information set that you're allowed. I can't immediately bring up a clear, difficult example to go to, but you're trying to convey only by answering questions to a jury what is going on. I sometimes say to people, okay, well, tell me about your holidays. Where have you, you know, tell me about your holidays. You can't tell me. I'm going to ask you questions. And I'm going to ask you questions about the color of your suitcase. And the weight of your suitcase, and the color of the clouds you flew through, and what was the ground like when you landed, you know, and they say, well, that's not telling me anything about my holiday. Yeah, but that's what it's like sometimes giving evidence in court when you can only respond to questions.
You talked about the very first case that you had with a victim lying on his back, and I believe it was a stab wound. And I'm just wondering how that felt the first time being called out, and just, you know, like, oh, you know, this is it. You're on the ride. You can't get off now. So,
well, absolutely so excited. I mean, I really was so excited to be really there, having wanted to do this since I was 13 and trained and gone to medical school and done all of these other things. Excuse me. You know, to be there and knowing that I had the knowledge and probably the skills, but not yet the experience to get it right, to do it properly, and to help the police and begin to form those relationships with crime scene officers, with police officers, with scientists that were going to stay with me for the rest of my career. It was just so exciting. It really, really was for me a great sense of achievement.
You also mentioned that, It was Dr. Ian West. So he was the boss at Guy's Hospital when you were working. And you'd mentioned that maybe I'm wrong. Was he the specialist in shooting in
well, or was he wasn't, he had a great interest. He shot himself and he had a great interest in gunshot injuries. And I was starting to work at the end of what we euphemistically call the Troubles, the Irish, you know, the war in Northern Ireland. There had been a lot of shootings, a lot of assassinations, a lot of bombings in London and around the UK. And Ian had been very deeply involved and gained a huge amount of experience from working with them. So he was sort of self-appointed, but he was actually very good at understanding and interpreting gunshot injuries.
You said he shot himself. Could you explain that?
Oh, sorry. He used to go out and shoot weapons himself, not shot. Sorry, yes. Sorry, two separated by a common language. He didn't shoot himself. He was himself a gun user.
Okay. I was just curious how dedicated he was to this profession. Okay.
Well, you know, we're all very keen, you know.
Yeah, of course. But you, on the other hand, you took an interest in knives and stab wounds and things like that. And you also mentioned things. Well, of course, in the UK, everyone says that, you know, stabbings are much more common in the UK.
Oh, yeah.
And you also mentioned that they were common with women.
Yeah.
So what was it about the knives that you felt you had, you know, that piqued your interest?
It was because statistically, very nearly 60% of all homicides are associated with knives in the UK. And certainly in domestic stabbings, domestic homicides, it goes way up into the 75, 80%. So it was a very, very common finding, and it seemed to me when I looked at it, actually there wasn't a huge amount of thought. Everyone just said, oh, it's a stab wound. And I thought, well, you know, what else can we deduce from these things that we're seeing and describing? You know, surely we can take this a bit further, bit of research, a bit of understanding about what's going on, rather than just saying, oh, it's a 2-centimeter stab wound penetrating 8 centimeters into the body and involving the heart. You know, okay, simple facts that are true, but we must be able to understand more where these are, how they are they multiple, are they single, what do they focus on, all of these things. And it seemed to me that this was, Ian was doing the gunshot wounds, but this was the common thing that I was seeing, not every day, but, you know, two or three times a week, and a bit of ripe bit of work for just some understanding and research.
So when you were working at Guy's, I mean, how far was it all over? It was mostly centered around London, or was it?
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate because the way forensic pathology was and is in the UK is very, very unstructured and very poorly organized. We used to all be associated, then I was associated with Guy's Hospital, but the universities decided in the end that they didn't like us anymore because we didn't do enough research. So we were thrown out of the universities, and that left us floating free. So how it was organized is far too complex and domestic and depressing for this for this video, but it's still not good. But we covered geographically about half of the population in the United Kingdom. For those who know England, we went from Bedford, which is in the Midlands, down to the south coast, out towards the east coast, and then out towards the centre of England, towards the west. So it was a huge geographical area. It would sometimes take me 2 hours or so, maybe not huge in Canada, but in the UK, 2 hours plus to drive to a scene.
Yeah. I want to ask you about some of the cases that you worked on. And in the book, you know, you list, you know, that night, that the dates around 1987 were very important. There was a lot of things that happened. And one of those things that you discussed was August 1987, Michael Ryan. It was the Hungerford killings. And that you happened to get on because I believe Ian was on vacation.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, how often the understudy gets the part because the lead is away, and that was very definitely me that day.
Yeah, and that one was, I mean, that was a big scene. I believe there were like 16 people that died from that in that one.
13 died, 13 injured. But the key thing in England, it was unique. You know, I mean, you know, we have spree killings now so commonly, but this was the first one that had occurred in England in this way, using semi-automatic rifles and handguns. You know, so I mean, it was a massive change in England in terms of homicides and serial killings.
Did you find it difficult to manage the number of bodies, or that, or were you fairly well prepared for that?
I think we were fairly well prepared. I mean, it was made easier, as so often happens in these cases, because the offender had committed suicide, and I was called to the scene not only to see the incident there, but to actually certify him dead, and to be certain that he had actually fired a gunshot that was suicidal, because there were suggestions in the press that the British Army had come in and the sniper had taken him out. But there were also suggestions from him during the hostage negotiations that he had a bomb strapped to him, and that, you know, they were worried that if this wasn't well documented and then they moved him and he got blown up with his own bomb, there would be difficulty establishing it. So, you know, they very kindly pushed me into a classroom with a school with him and shut the door and said, don't move him. And I said, no, I won't. I promise you I won't move him at all. But no, managing it was, because it was something I think I'd read about, and management of other types of mass disasters, we just took it slowly and methodically. You know, there was no rush. We weren't going to let it be a rush. It was just going to be working our way through, documenting everything, on the assumption that he wasn't the only person involved, that there might have been someone else, and proving all of the weapons that he had were the ones that were used.
There was it was only, I think, three or four months later, there was the King's Cross fire at the, I guess it was the Piccadilly line, and 1987 again. Yeah. And now we have, you know, almost twice as many fatalities there. So are you, in that case, do you spread the examinations amongst the people that are there? Sure. Or how did that work?
In certainly with the King's Cross fire, yes, there were three or four pathologists. The facilities were nowhere near as good. There was much greater pressure from the public and from families to identify. See, one of the things about Hungerford that made it easier was identification was never an issue. Identification was done very quickly and easily, although there were some injuries, that these bodies were not disfigured in any way. Whereas with King's Cross, there were a lot of severely burnt people. There were a lot of people who'd been injured. And that trying to establish the list of fatalities was crucial, as so often happens in mass disasters. Who is it is the first question, and then how.
Well, that was the case with the Marchioness disaster, right? The boat disaster. So in that case, in your book, you talk about, you know, there were bodies that weren't found for days, or maybe even weeks, a couple of weeks in some cases.
I can't quite remember the timing, but it's certainly, in fact, the man whose party it was the last person to be discovered. And he'd been in the River Thames, going up and down in the River Thames for many, many days. But even the bodies that were recovered, there were about 52 fatalities, and about 23 or 24 were recovered from inside the boat the next day. So we had a tranche that were well preserved, easily identifiable, easily managed. But we had another tranche that came up individually and in small groups. But it was August. The Thames is quite a warm river. There was a lot of decomposition occurring very quickly.
Yeah. And so again, there were managing the identification. In that case, that's a very critical question, is who actually is this? And after decomposition starts, it's not as easy, or it's easy to mistake somebody for somebody else, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in that case, there was difficulty in actually just trying to figure out who was actually on the boat.
Well, yes, you know, it was a 30-year-old party. Lots of people were there. They brought friends. People didn't turn up. People did turn up. There were gate crashes. I mean, it was a 30-year-old's birthday party. And they were, you know, tragically, they were having such a good time. And I've been on boats on the Thames and other rivers, you know, where there's been a party and a disco, and it's just been great fun. And I can't really imagine that moment where it turned from fun to this awful, awful situation.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your involvement with the death of Lady Diana, Princess Diana, because in that one, you were called to help with the investigation, and you actually went over to France and you did, you were speaking with the forensic pathologist there, and you found some interesting things, nothing that you thought was of malice, but just some things that were maybe out of practice. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about that particular case and how you got involved?
I wasn't involved initially is the key thing. A colleague of mine, Dr. Rob Chapman, actually performed the postmortems on Lady Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed. He was the pathologist on call, and he took the call and performed those examinations. But as I'm sure everyone remembers, the conspiracy theories didn't go away. They began to multiply. You know, it was tremendous pressure was caused. And so the man who was then the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, the man who later became Lord Stevens, decided that there should be a full and thorough investigation in the UK of the deaths. Because up to this time, of course, it had all been done by the French police, and the traffic reconstructions and everything had been done by then. He decided, I think, obviously with advice and help from other areas, that there should be a full investigation of all of the aspects. And I was called in to provide the pathology, the forensic pathology review of what had happened in the accident. So I came in at a late stage, two or three years later, in this review. And just looking, you know, it is interesting. It's a good learning experience to review someone else's case, whatever it is, and say, oh, would I have done that? did, oh, that's good. I like the way they did that. Gosh, I can learn from that. But in this case, it was done in France. And there were, I think, some huge, you know, I can't imagine what it was like in France trying to manage the death of a member of a divorced member of the royal family, you know, the mother of the king to be. The pressures were huge. And I know, having been involved in mass disasters, the way these pressures come in, people always want you to do things quickly. There's always the push to get it done yesterday, to do it in 10 minutes, to do it in an hour. And this is why, you know, with Hungerford, I set a plan that I followed through. You go at your speed. Because if you try and rush and you make a mistake, the people who've been pushing you suddenly are not going to be standing by your side saying, oh, no, he did it for me. They're going to say, well, you did it wrong. And so push. And there was a lovely, really, really nice professor of the French mortuary, Professor Lecon, who was a delightful lady who they didn't have an on-call system. They just did cases as they came in, and she was dragged out of her bed at 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning to go and examine Princess Diana in the hospital to comment on her injuries, and then to come back to the mortuary and perform a post-mortem on a man called Henri Paul, who was the driver of the Mercedes in which three people I died. One of them was him. So looking at all these things, putting it together. Of course, the person of interest to the press was Lady Diana. She suffered a very strange and unusual injuries, and she had a vascular tear in her left lung, which is why she was apparently well for quite a long time before she then collapsed on way to the hospital. But the crucial person was obviously Henri Paul. What was he doing? Why was he doing it? What was the speed of the car and all of those things? And my view very early on was that, you know, Mercedes are generally very good cars. It had all the bells and whistles, you know, the airbags, the seatbelts, but of course, none of them were wearing them. So apart from a man called Trevor Rees-Jones, who was Diana's bodyguard, who lived... He had very severe injuries, but did actually live. He was the one survivor. And he said, you know, he realized something was going wrong and managed to get his seatbelt on just before the car hit the pillar. So it was understanding all those things together. So really, really interesting to work with a fascinating, high-powered team that had a lot of clout behind it. And my word, you can get things done when you've got a lord of the House, a member of the House of Lords, holding an investigation. Things move quite quickly, unnoticed.
Yeah, I can imagine something like that. Let me ask you about things which are even larger. So, for example, you know, the tsunami victims in the Boxing Day tsunami there that one year, or for example, 9/11, you know, things like that, which are just enormous, and they span international borders and things like that. I mean, how for example, you assisted with 9/11.
Yeah.
So how what's the mechanism? I mean, does you know, somebody from the US make a call? Is it the people in England that say, look, we need somebody to go over? How does that typically work?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't help with 9/11. I was sent over because the British government needed to understand what was happening. We needed, I think the phrase might now be, you know, eyes on it. We needed someone to go and look and say, what is happening in New York? What is happening? How are they managing it? Is it something we're going to accept? Because without getting too bogged down, English law says now that if a body is returned from abroad to the UK, the English coroner still has to take what is legally called an interest in that death. And often if it's a traumatic death, if it's an accidental or a suicidal or homicidal death, the coroner may decide to hold an inquest. So there was a legal process that had to be satisfied in England. And we were very, very concerned that if we didn't have a solitary view of what was being done, different coroners around the country, and you have the same thing in the States and in Canada, I guess, you know, where the coroners and the MEs can do their own thing. We really wanted a unified response. How many? What were the names? How was it being managed? So that was what I was sent out to view by the British government, by the Metropolitan Police, and by the coroner. And that was what I did. I formed that opinion and said that they were doing it really well. The guys were working very hard. The paperwork was good. The processes were good. And that if the body was returned to England, we didn't need then to start thinking about having a further post-mortem examination on those bodies that came back to England, which is crucial because, you know, these families have been shocked and distressed enough for them to say, yes, we found your loved one and they're coming back to England. Oh, by the way, the English coroner is going to have another post-mortem performed. That was just awful.
Right. Yeah. Let me ask you about, there's two things on my mind. One is the working with obviously young children, babies. So for example, SIDS, the sudden infant death syndrome was a very interesting time. And of course there were varied opinions on SIDS and what it meant. But can you give us just a quick sort of background on what the impact of SIDS was in forensic pathology?
Well, I think, yes, it was coming in as I was really sort of beginning to move into the field and doing regular postmortems. I mean, these deaths, nobody really understood, but they were just, in a sense, just dealt with as tragic events. And then slowly we began to realize that there were patterns, not me, but others working in this field. And they said that working in the pediatric hospitals and full research, full investigation, saying we do not understand what is happening here. And they created this category of sudden infant death syndrome, which was very useful in many ways because it allowed us to focus on these cases that had the complete plethora of investigations from x-rays down to microscopy, bacteriology, everything. That was the good thing that enabled us to focus and have protocols to work through them. The bad thing was that it also gave other people a dustbin in which to throw a load of cases because they couldn't be bothered to do the work. They just said, oh, it's sudden infant death syndrome. And end of story. And once again, I referred to the variability of coroners and MEs. You know, there were some coroners in England who said, there is no such thing. I don't believe it. I'm not going to allow you to put that on your death certificate. So there were problems. In the end, it has, I think, been beneficial. It's allowed us to focus on this group and mainly for the specialist pediatric pathologists to know where they're going. And so much has come out of this research, you know, putting your child on its back to sleep, not overheating it, worrying about mattresses and old mattresses and things of that sort has been really good. And then, of course, that has then bumped into the sudden infant death syndrome, has rather bumped into the battered baby, the child abuse, and there's been the crossover managing that. And then we slide from that into shaken baby and the triad, you know, and all sorts of problems that are coming up. And it has been quite a fascinating time to watch this change going on throughout my career.
I wanted to ask you about a few different things. And one thing that came to mind is inside of the, you know, or while you're doing the autopsy, are the people who are there with you, for example, today, if you were to do an autopsy, are they the same people that were there 40 years ago?
Yes, they are, because the fundamental, it depends what sort of autopsy I'm doing. If I'm doing what we would call routine, so this is a non-suspicious trauma, natural causes, death. That's we have the anatomical pathology technicians. They used to be essentially untrained people. They used to be mortuary keepers, and the mortuaries used to be little buildings in the middle of cemeteries. So they took bodies in and put bodies out, and they perhaps dig graves in the afternoon. Now they are a highly trained, highly skilled specialist group. So same bodies, same people, but now they are fantastically trained and so much better at doing and understanding their job. In terms of suspicious deaths, once again, yes, I have. I'll have an investigating officer. I'll have a photographer. I'll have a crime scene investigator, and I'll have scientists or specialist scientists like ballistics if I need them. So the group of people hasn't really changed a lot.
There were a couple of cases that you talked about, and you had some involvement with this after all. You took an interest, but they had to do with, for example, an individual getting arrested, and based on the way that they were restrained, it caused a death. Or for example, somebody in custody, and then, you know, based on how they were restrained again. And I mean, we've seen this in North America and US recently. Yeah. So what kinds of things came out of those cases, and what, did you develop training methods, or what kinds of things did you do post those cases?
Yeah, we had two or three, as it seems to happen in quick succession. The first one was a lady called Joy Gardner, who was said to be an illegal immigrant. She was being arrested to be taken, deported. She struggled. And not the police officers, but the immigration officers wound a piece of, we call it elastoplasty, I don't know whether you call it surgical tape, 13 feet of surgical tape were wound around her mouth and nose. And not surprisingly, perhaps, she suffered asphyxiation, suffered brain damage, and eventually died. And that was the first one that really came to my attention. But then we had other cases with people just being restrained, sat on, controlled by police officers. This was long before the days of Taser. And often these would just be what I would describe as a rugby scrum. They're just, you know, four police officers just pile on top and simply use their weight and gripping to restrain them. And these people were dying too. And I realized talking to them that they had no concept of how it was people breathed, and that by sitting on people, you were going to cause problems. Well, it doesn't happen on the rugby field. Well, no, but these guys on the rugby field probably aren't up to their eyeballs in cocaine and other drugs as well. So all of these things, and we used that time. We held two or three seminars at St. George's when I was back working there. And then we got involved in training police officers and talking to them about, you know, maintaining the airways, someone being responsible for making sure the person could breathe and could see, and, you know, that telling them the simple medical physiological facts. And I can't say we have no cases in the United Kingdom, but I like to think that by teaching them this, which they took on very quickly, I mean, the police were very fast in their training methods to take this on board, because the devastation it caused, I mean, I know to the families of the people who died, it was awful, but to the police officers involved in this, it was awful as well. You know, there are very few who would have chosen to kill this person, and it would ruin their lives, ruin their careers. And so the police were very fast. And I touch wood, you know, I think it has had an effect in the UK and the training, and a reduction in the number of deaths. And of course, tasers and things like that help too.
I want to ask you about something that you start with at the beginning of Unnatural Causes, and you also sort of end with, and that has to do with emotional wellness, PTSD, and those sorts of things. So obviously, you know, everyone is different, of course. And I, you know, speaking for myself, I've only had a couple of situations where I've been confronted with something which was just very uncomfortable, you know, with death and that sort of thing, in cases where I was just, there. And somebody like yourself that is getting called out to these mass murders and all these terrible situations, over time, they may cause some problems. And in your book, well, you're a pilot, so it's, there's one part of the book where you talk where, you know, you're flying, and then you're sort of having an uncomfortable episode, let's call it. And so I wanted to ask you about how that came to be, how you first realized that, you know, things were starting to pile on for you.
Well, it is interesting, because I think we all develop a carapace. We all develop a thick skin. You know, we can cope with this. And in fact, the trigger for me, we've talked about Hungerford. We talked about it being one of the first cases back in 1987. A long, long time later, I was flying my aircraft, and I realized I was actually flying over the top of Hungerford. We're quite near Heathrow, so the air traffic control are quite keen that you know where you are. And so I was there. And without realizing it, once I twigged I was over the top of Hungerford, or near Hungerford, I had a very bizarre, how can I call it, sort of out of body, just an unusual sensation. You know, was it real? Was it not real? Was it physical? Was it mental? What was actually going on here? And that was the first inclination many, many years later. And we're now talking about the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, this happened that I realized that something perhaps was involving me a bit deeper. And in the end, bizarrely, it was something that linked back to another mass disaster, linking back to Bali, the bombing in Bali. Once again, I was went out there, very similar role to the one I played in World Trade Center. So this was in 2002, about 13 months later on. There were real problems with the infrastructure there, problems with keeping the bodies cool, and bags of ice had been got from supermarkets in the initial stages before proper refrigeration was there. And it was just putting a cube of ice into my wife's gin and tonic one night that actually triggered the memory of Bali. And that moment then, those 200 odd people died. I mean, a lot of fragmentation with double bombings and burning. It was an awful situation. But that simple act, doing something so common, just getting a piece of ice out of a plastic bag, open this sort of this trap door, and suddenly all of the memories of Hungerford and World Trade and individual cases and kids' deaths and kids' natural deaths and accidents, all of these things just suddenly came out, and they rendered me completely unable to do anything. I certainly couldn't work. I mean, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't make decisions. And it was a very unpleasant, fortunately brief with treatment, episode of acute anxiety and depression. It was a very unpleasant. Eventually, a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder was made. And I had some psychotherapy as well as some chemical therapy in terms of an antidepressant drug. And I would say I'm back to what passes for normal now. But it did actually make me say to my colleagues, you know, you've got to think all the time. I thought I was immune. I thought I'd done everything and seen everything. And apart from blips in my smoking habits and my drinking habits during mass disasters, which always resolved quite quickly afterwards, I hadn't noticed any changes, but yet it was there. And so I try and encourage my colleagues now to spend some time on wellness and on talking to professionals or colleagues to get through this.
It strikes me that in the book, there were several occasions where, for example, someone is inside of the autopsy room and you can see that there's this uncomfortable situation and you know that they're going to walk away with this memory that it's just not going to fade. But in the room, you're probably really good with other people. I imagine you're probably an expert now with saying, hey, talking them through and, you know, conversation and yeah.
Yeah. I think remembering back to my training days, the worst thing I found was just standing watching someone else mutilate a body. When you know the value of what's being done, you understand why it's being done, and that there is a benefit and a usefulness for these processes that can be seen if you're just observing them from nowhere, a terribly mutilating event. And I did realize that, you know, often the police were not good about briefing people before they came into the room, or, you know, particularly the police, but I guess there were some scientists as well that were sort of brought in. And I tried to make sure that I was explaining, I would always try and talk as though I was talking to the senior officers, but keeping an eye on these other guys, but, you know, because I wanted them to go away and go, yeah, that wasn't pleasant, but it was really useful. And I understand why it was done and I can justify what's going on. And that I felt was important, that these people who were brought in a little against their will often weren't then traumatized and left with a memory that would linger forever.
So if you had to go back, or for example, for, you know, people who are watching this, maybe they're young pathologists getting started and, you know, they want to get into this, what kinds of things do you think could help along the way so that, you know, it doesn't come to a head all at one point?
Well, I think what we're trying to instigate in the UK now is that all of the people who are registered Home Office forensic pathologists, so we use the term Home Office pathologist. These are just our home office here just has a list of people on it. That's the only reason we call Home Office pathologists, is that, you know, that they should actually go and see some counselor once a year. They don't have to talk about their work. They don't have to talk about anything. They can just go and sit and drink tea and talk about golf or cricket or football. But the point is, it puts them in a room one-to-one with a person who, if they do have psychological, mental health needs, is there to offer that support. So nobody knows what they're talking to them about. And I always felt that if we insisted that everyone did it, then it gave those that needed it the option without it standing out. But, you know, it is a question of watching your colleagues. And this is when I'm talking about managing mass disasters. One of the things I'm always saying, watch your colleagues. Beware the person that's gone quiet. Beware the person that isn't in the evening, is sitting on their own. Beware the person who is there. They need your help. They are dissociating. There are problems brewing, and, you know, and we all need that debriefing, that counselling post mass disasters. But, you know, that's just single events. We need it throughout our career. I mean, I know that my wife is a forensic paediatrician. Her hospital insists that she goes to see a forensic psychologist once every 3 months. You know, so within the hospital environment, it's being done. It's because of our unusual situation within the criminal justice system as forensic pathologists in this country that we have to do it ourselves. And that's wrong.
Yeah. Well, I think you make an interesting point about, you know, watching out for your colleagues, because maybe in the past that wasn't, people were worrying about themselves, maybe, and not so much about others, but, you know, often...
Yeah. You never know the guy who's in the room, with a road traffic case. You know, actually his father was killed. He didn't want to be there, and suddenly he finds himself there, and he's got a lot of background you don't know anything about. But it's only by watching carefully that you'll pick that up.
Yeah, I think so, and I've noticed too that you alluded to this in the book as well. But humor is often helpful in those situations, and Yeah. I can only imagine.
it's a delicate line, because if you're not careful, you know, black humor is there, and it has to be viewed with great care. So yes, but with delicacy, I think is the important thing. But yeah, humor can break that tension quite well.
I want to ask you about what surprises or along your career, what were some of the things that may have surprised you at the autopsy? Like something showed up that was like, whoa, I've never seen this before. What things stand out for you?
That's a really, really difficult question to answer, mm-hmm. because there's so much normal pathology that we have to know about and we see. And without it being an I Spy book, it's actually quite nice when you see a bit of classical pathology. You know, for instance, you know, a ruptured aneurysm. You know, actually they're quite common. But, you know, when the first season, wow, you know, I've learnt about this and I've looked at microscope slides and I've learnt all about it. And here it is. It's in exactly the right place, doing exactly the right things. And so sometimes when you do that, sometimes it's the rarities. Sometimes it's the oddities. I mean, when people haven't cut their toenails forever, they get these huge, they're called ram's horns, and it's got a wonderful name, a onychogryphosis of the toenails. And they really are these, you know, and has it killed them? No, it hasn't. But you know it exists, and what's its value? Well, none in terms of their cause of death, other than you can say this person has not been taking care of themselves sufficiently well, and their social services haven't been caring for them because they wouldn't have let. There are these ancillary markers that we can look to, and we have to notice as well as the stab wound to the back.
I was thinking early this morning that you must have an absolutely incredible map of the human body in your head because of the way everything is laid out and where you're going to find things. So, I'm just thinking about that, but your understanding of the human body internally must be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, well, I'm very, very fortunate. Of course, the human body doesn't change much and hasn't for thousands of years. So I'm on a bit of a winner there. You know, the heart does tend to be, you know, 0.1% of the population, the heart's on the right side of the chest. And these anomalies we have to know about and understand, you know, particularly dealing with children, you know, the errors in the anatomy, errors in metabolism, errors in other things that are crucially important. We all have to have them. But please, please don't ask me the name of a muscle or a nerve because, you know, I'm really not that good an anatomist. I have got a fantastic app on my iPad that tells me the names of things if I need to know them.
Yeah, actually, you raise a really good point, and something that you raised in your book too is, you know, you say bodies don't change, but there have been things that have been changing with bodies over the course of your career that you mentioned. So, for example, body size. People are getting heavier. Body markings, and you also brought up something, and I wonder if you can comment on this too. It had to do with people with harming themselves, like people self-harm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these patterns, tattoos, I think, are the thing that have changed so much. You know, I was recently at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences down in Florida, and just the number of people with tattoos who were attending the conference, it was such a surprise to me. But body piercings and actually the self harm patterns that are caused, and the implements that are used, all of those aspects that are going on are changing. But I think the biggest thing is body weight. I mean, it's huge. I really notice it when I look back at the photographs that I have, the crime scene photographs, how thin people were in 1987, and you know, you just they're just not that thin anymore. And it's, in a sense, it's not a surprise, particularly in terms of natural death, because, you know, obesity, overweight, and these things are crucially important in contributing to natural death.
Yeah, I'm jumping around here, but now you just brought into my mind that you actually developed your own way of cutting a certain cut. And I'm not sure if it's called the shepherd's cut or whatever, but it had to do with the way you fold over certain parts of the skin or whatever.
Yeah, it was really to try and be aware that once I've finished, the mortuary techs have got to recreate the body, and the family will then want to view it. And it's just trying to make that viewing process better for the family. Now, most families will not ask to see the body naked, but, you know, if they do, then, you know, we have to make sure that they are viewable. We can't hide the incisions that we make. We make them as little obvious as we possibly can, but they can't be made to disappear. And so, you know, trying to think that little bit further through and to find different ways of making incisions that are more easily hidden are better, to make the experience of those few members of the families who want to see the body naked. There are some religious groups who will want to do it, to wash the body of the family. And that's crucially important, that, you know, we don't cause them any greater distress by being just without doing things without thinking, you know, and thinking of the relatives is always something that has to be there. And we have to have the skills and the techniques to do these things as well as we possibly can.
Yeah, dealing with the people is the hardest part, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, comes back to mass disasters. And so often people would say, oh, you know, just remember them as they were. No, that's not how we got to do it. In the London bombings, we spend a lot of time designing and planning mortuary, but also the relatives area, the time that was there, and spending time with families there. We'd organized it very well, I think, that meant that the families could go through it at their own speed. And I was very insistent that sometimes it may take 3 or 4 days, 3 or 4 visits before the family get to where they want to get to. And then you must always leave the door open and say, if you need to come back, you always can. Because the one thing I learned in general medicine, particularly doing obstetrics, is that if people have a fantasy, it's always worse than the reality. Always, always, always worse than the reality. They think things are terrible. And in fact, if we can say to them, no, and here is the reality, and you can cope with it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about seven ages. So at what point, first off, I got to give you credit, because anyone who can write as well as you do and for sit for as long and focus for that long has got my respect, because I just can't focus that long. But seven ages of death, I have it up on the screen for those that are interested. But what caused you to say, hey, you know, I need to write this book? Were you paused in your career for a time, and this is the
Yeah, I mean, really, I was sort of coming to and into retirement, so I had time, more time than I really knew what to do with in many ways. But I was very keen, when I look back at the autobiographies that had been written by my predecessor, so often they were, hey, let me tell you how clever I am in 20 cases. I also wanted to show a little bit about some of the many things we've been talking about here, Eugene, you know, the effect on me, the effect on my family life, the effect on my kids. You know, all of these things are interwoven in a long career. And the seven ages are because it was obvious to me that people die of different things in throughout their life. You know, children die of metabolic disorders and congenital abnormalities. Old people die of, middle-aged people die of coronary artery disease. Old people die of dementia, you know, simply. And it was looking at how the body changes and the cases I'd had to deal with in those seven ages. And the seven ages is the Shakespearean quote that we all remember, you know, mewling and puking in the mother's arms, and then nobody remembers the bit in the middle, and you get to sans eyes, sans teeth, sans everything. And, you know, all of these situations are those that forensic pathologists have to manage, you know, and it's doing a post-mortem on someone at middle age is not the same as doing a post-mortem on someone who's 80 or 90. You know, even if they've died from trauma, there are differences, and you have to understand and manage them.
And then, of course, unnatural causes was a little different twist, you know, to just talking more about the cases. Yeah. But here, this is, and I have to let everybody know, both of these books are excellent books. I especially reading unnatural causes, it's about as close as I could get to understanding, you know, forensic pathology without actually being there. And so I think you did a wonderful job on here, but you made this very personal. You talk about family life, you talk about wellness, you talk about a lot of different things. And so what was the motivation here in unnatural causes?
Well, yes, the motivation was someone from a publishing house called Penguin wrote to me and said, why don't you write an autobiography, which was always a good start, because normally people write it and then need to find a publishing house. So that was the key. Although I have to say, actually, they wrote to me in 1992 and said, write an autobiography. And I said, I'm not yet there, you know. Let me have a career, then I'll do one. So that was Unnatural Causes was the first of the two books, but it really was writing an autobiography, that, and I was determined it wasn't just going to be a list of 20 cases that I thought I'd done well as. I wanted to tell the story of my life in and how it interwove with my career.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I think it was a great book. And again, for all of the people that are listening or watching, and especially, like I said, if you are a student and you're looking to get into forensic pathology, it's a great resource. I think it'll give you really some really great insight.
And a little publicity for me, it's out in about, I can't remember now, I think it's 25 different languages. So
is it really?
there's no excuse for not buying it. I can't tell you what they all are, but it's Korean, Chinese, French, German, probably not American, but there we are.
No, but it is very well written. It's a great read. So what's next for you, Richard? Like, are you writing again? Are you still involved with other organizations and things like that?
Yeah, well, a little bit. I mean, I think I've been retired now for so long, I have to be careful to step away from casework, because I'm not doing it. And you know, you got to stay sharp. You can't commit yourself down that line. I've done a couple of tours around the UK, having an evening with when I tell the tale of a little bit of my life, but also about a particular incident, a domestic incident, ends up someone being stabbed. And we talk about how we do the examination. And we actually have a body that we wheel onto the stage, which is which always gets a bit of a gasp from the audience. And then we have a court scene. So I've done that twice now, and we're looking to go to Australia, New Zealand, probably in spring of our spring, British spring of 2024. I keep swinging past writing another book, but as you say, it's knowing what I'm committing myself to that keeps stopping me. But I think we're moving there, but possibly more, more fictional than autobiographical.
Excellent. Well, look, I think we're going to stop it here. We've covered a ton of topics, and look, I can't thank you enough. I'm just really fascinated now. Just sort of, I've known, forensic pathologists, I've done interviews, but I have to tell you, it was a rejuvenation of interest in the field again, based on a lot of the cases and the work that you've done. So again, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Eugene, for asking me. I mean, I have to say, I've done over 20,000 PMs. If I could go back to starting at medical school again tomorrow, I would go back without a moment's hesitation. And I love my career, even with its problems here and there. But, I would go back and do it again if I possibly could.
Well, look, do me a favor. Hang back. I'm just going to say some closing comments. But, hey, thank you very much. And we'll chat in a bit.
My pleasure.
Well, I'm going to leave it at that. I want to thank everybody. I see that there's people in the comments section. Thank you for all the comments. Thank you for being involved here and everything else. And I want to wish everybody a really wonderful, wonderful Thursday. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.